Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. What are the massive issues of the day you are tackling with your work? From understanding how systems affect behavior and relationships, to the value of creative labor and equity for artists, today's guest on Getting Work to Work does not shy away from complex and challenging issues. Jenny Gao is a full-time artist and entrepreneur who creates incredible works of art, from printmaking to public art. On top of that, she also curates exhibits and experiences that tell diverse stories. In our conversation, Jenny talks about the power of creativity as an innate force for change, why entrepreneurship is for artists, and how artists can be visionary leaders and change makers. She even shares the exact moment she wanted to be an artist and what type of art she would do. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/477. Jenny, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It is wonderful to talk with you today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Absolutely. So I love asking this question of everyone because it expands my own curiosity. But what are you endlessly curious about?
So I'm endlessly curious about how systems affect behavior and relationships. I'm the daughter of immigrants of two families who came from very different places in the world. And I grew up in rural Kansas in a very insular small town. And just a lot of my life experiences have made me sensitive to how systems influence chains of events and shape human behavior. So that's something I could spend hours thinking about.
Wow. So when you say systems, what does that mean to you?
Yeah. So that could be constructed systems. So you think about a manufacturing workflow. It could be social systems. So the interpersonal dynamics between people, cultural systems, and I guess on a much larger level, ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And just what goes into an environment that either makes it in balance or out of balance.
Wow. That's awesome. What's so great is when this episode comes out, it'll be the second episode of the year. And the person right before you, we had a long conversation about systems. So it's amazing just how much systems is on the mind of people, whether it's business systems or social systems. And I just think it's great that we're having that level of conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's just I'm glad more people are thinking of it because that's where the real paradigm shifts are possible.
Mm. How so?
Well, because frameworks dictate a lot of the way that we behave and make decisions. And the good thing about frameworks is that they provide a lot of stability and makes it possible for us to do things more efficiently, in more orderly, a more safe way. But a framework that's too rigid can become oppressive and create a lot of problems within it. And I stay away from saying that systems are broken. Systems aren't broken. They're doing exactly what they're designed to do. And whatever feedback goes into them, that's what's going to get amplified. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it so hard to often change things that we see as problematic, right? You think about racism or sexism and the ways in which these things can inhibit large percentages of the population. And so essentially, There are small ways in which we can see we can make this change here, we can make this change here, but the overarching framework is still the same. And so it's still producing the undesirable behavior that we want in the system and the undesirable results. But when we can actually see what that framework is, then we can change that. And then with it, all the behaviors that result from that system, instead of tackling them one by one.
Wow. That's just so big and massive. And as you're describing this world of systems, it really brings some illumination to a phrase that I just love on your website that you say, getting to the root of what makes us who we are. And I'm curious, like, that connects deeply to systems, but how does this statement affect you as both the artist and the work you do?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I'll answer this from, I guess, like, both a personal and a social perspective. From a personal perspective, I got a little bit into it with the first question that I'm the daughter of immigrants. My mom immigrated to here from Taiwan, and my dad immigrated from China, and they came from very different experiences growing up in Taiwan and China, and very different eras. My dad lived through the Cultural Revolution and the Great Famine, and that was the era that he came up in. And my mom was a bit younger, and so she lived through a lot of the after effects of China resuming control of Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, both my parents were on the one hand shaped by very different experiences in Asia, but on the other hand, shared a very similar impetus for why they decided to immigrate here and become a part of the Asian diaspora. With that decision comes a lot of unresolved trauma. They both went through some pretty awful stuff, and they carry that into our family framework here. And, you know, for somebody like me, who's a second generation American and living with parents who are suffering from the effects of that unresolved trauma, the answer for me was not to say, like, sever ties or to try to get away from anything that was toxic in my family. It was more important that I stay connected to my roots and understand and be able to dismantle where that suffering came from in order to be able to break the cycle and also have an understanding of who I am in the context of the events that have happened in the world that led to the Asian diaspora. That's on a personal level, like, what it means to me as far as, like, getting to the root of who we are. And then, you know, on a social level, it is on all of us to develop both this self and social awareness in order to be able to resolve complex issues. And one topic, you know, that I get into in my work is this concept of, like, intimate points of disagreement. And you think, like, you think of, like, the conflict, say, like, between generations or between races, between different belief systems. And the question is, like, is it possible to name our pain as a way of confronting it and therefore dismantling it?
Wow. Name our pain in order to dismantle it. What I appreciate about that so much is it's such a, I guess the first word that pops into my mind is such a mature way of looking at it and a responsible way to look at it.
Yeah.
I'm really taken back by what you said earlier as well of just, you know, not, you wanted to break the cycle and be able to move beyond it. I mean, that had to have been challenging and probably still challenging.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. These things are hard to solve, even when we recognize what the forces at play are.
What made you want to be an artist?
You know, it's something I've wanted ever since I was very young. And, you know, I remember having, the best way I can describe it was a vision when I was 3 years old that I needed to be an artist. And specifically, I wanted to be an artist and a writer who was able to put both words and images to what she saw. And, you know, I think that ran up against a lot of just, like, the social challenges of becoming an artist. And certainly within my family, my parents were very opposed to me becoming an artist. And that either results in people turning away their dreams or rebelling against expectations. And luckily for me, it was the latter. And so it really pushed me to question, well, why was this so important to me? Why was it important for me to become an artist? Then from there, develop my philosophy as an artist who believes in the power of creativity as an innate force for change across all life forms, and specifically art as a way in which human beings enact creativity in this world. I mean, we're the only animals that actively record the information of the world around us. And I think that's incredibly special.
Yeah. I mean, I love the philosophy of just creativity is change, and being, in a sense, change makers as artists, as creative professionals, as people who are bringing our imaginations to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you're wanting to be both artist and writer, how do you manage, I guess, the tension between those two worlds? Because, you know, left brain, right brain sometimes.
Oh yeah, you've nailed it. It's absolutely a right brain, left brain challenge, because the left side of our brain is the verbal side and the right brain is the nonverbal side. And I think this is the frustrating thing about a world that is very much set up for the left brain, that the left brain is always interpreting what the right brain means, right? And it never exactly gets it right. But the right brain has no way of telling this to anybody in the world, because it's just it can't speak on its own behalf in the way that the left brain can. And I think that part of it is recognizing the tension and not trying to remove the tension, but recognizing what can come of it and working with that. And so, you know, I think a lot about how the power of visuals is that we can get a lot of information across very quickly with visuals that we simply cannot do with words. And, you know, 70% of our sensory information comes through our eyes, and all of our other senses share the remaining 30%. And so that tells us so much about like what sorts of visual creatures human beings are. Like, visuals are really important. And then with that, you know, because we have no way of like really like interpreting what another person means through purely visual communication, this is where words come in handy. And they're never going to be an exact translation, but they can get us close. And so we can get like within proximity of each other. So like these nonverbal parts of us that don't have a common language can build an approximation through words and get a lot more information in that way. And it's a slower way of consuming information. We can't read a full page of text as quickly as we can look at an image, but we can get a lot more in depth with something that we might otherwise not have access to.
I really like how you describe, you know, we don't have to eliminate the tension, but what do you do with the tension? And that's, I feel a sense of relief, because it's just like, okay, I don't have to get rid of it, but what do I do with it? I mean, that's, it's a much more productive question.
Yeah, for sure.
It also helps me to think too, is like, how can you develop a system of creativity that takes tension as an input and transforms it into something?
That's a good question. Yeah.
Because instead of like, let's take a system like social media, where it takes an input like tension and just, you know, like it becomes this monster that wants to consume everyone. That's one way to do it. But, you know, what could be the constructive or the life altering, society changing alternative to that?
For sure. Yeah. One of the things that I often like to say to people is the internet and social media would be vastly different places if the people designing them had social work and library science degrees. And I mean, you know, it's just, that's not based in any study. That's based on like, perhaps like some of like my own perspective of the world. But, yeah. You know, especially like if you've seen documentaries like The Social Dilemma, or like followed any of the research on the way social media is impacting us, one of the things that you learn is that like a big part of the problem is that social media that is built by primarily young white men who go to college and learn human behavior, right? They learn how human behavior and human psychology works, and then they're taught to implement that knowledge in a space that is designed for monetization. I'm like, and well, there's your problem. Like, that's why social media is designed the way it is, to exploit your attention and your race to the bottom of the brainstem, and essentially at the end of the day to monetize you. And that if the people who are studying human behavior weren't people who are then immediately going to go and apply it to something that's backed by a venture capitalist, like if instead it was like human behavior for the purpose of social work and social causes towards things like you think of like what like the public library represents in society, right? Like what sort of like bastion it is. If these became the frameworks instead, we'd have a very different looking internet.
Yeah. What I really appreciate about you, Jenny, is that you do not shy away from the big issues, not only in the creative world, but just the world. And as you're describing the nature of social media to monetize our attention, I can't help but think about how it, in some ways, has moved away from the value of creativity and the value of creative labor. And streaming music is one example where, you know, artists are now getting paid pennies on the dollar. And if you're a giant artist, you can in a sense capitalize on those pennies. But if you're just starting out, you're kind of screwed because you can't live on pennies.
Yep, that's exactly it.
I'm curious how we can really start changing the conversation around, you know, as a society and as a creative community, talking more in depth about the value of creative labor. So like, where do we start with that? Where do we start the conversation around creative labor?
Well, one of the topics that that I discuss a lot with my work is that of equity for artists. And I explicitly call out artists because I think a lot of the times you hear things like support the arts. And what that means is support artistic programming in the community, but it leaves out the person who actually produces the work. And that's how you end up with large arts nonprofit centers that get big donors backing them for millions of dollars. And so a city will get, you know, the nonprofit arts center, they'll get the performing arts center, they'll get all of these things, but the artists aren't doing any better. And so we have to center the question of equity around the artist, the person who's producing the work, who's doing the labor. And that's where we will see change.
So what does that equity look like? Is it, you know, a 1-to-1? Is it a 1-to-3 where the artist, you know, makes a livable wage? And because right now it seems like, you know, the artists don't make anything or very little, and like these organizations are making all of the money.
Yeah. You know, I think it's going to depend on the scale of the operation. I don't think there's going to be like one formula that applies to every structure, but that it does need to start with what's not only a livable wage, but fair in terms of the value that's generated. You know, like people will say that like, well, okay, $15 or $20 an hour is a livable wage. Like, okay, great. Like, I'm not like, it's 2020, like let's aspire for a little bit more than making $30,000 before taxes. we don't have this question for professionals in other industries. We don't question a lawyer if they're being unreasonable for wanting to make $300 an hour. That's just what the industry supports. And we know that creative intellectual property is the basis of so much profit. Like the reason that companies and municipalities keep hiring artists to do things like murals and public artworks and community engagement projects is because they make everything else in the city more valuable. And so why wouldn't this also be not just a livable wage for the artist, but something that is very profitable to them?
Right. Well, even as you're describing, like, you know, public art, murals and all that, if we look at just even streaming platforms in the time of COVID, where, you know, what's the first thing that people do, you know, when they're home, you know, they start watching Netflix. But then you start looking at, you know, what happens when a giant company like Disney has to shut down two or more of their revenue streams. And so, you know, they start changing their model to support streaming media, which is all about artists again at that point. You know, commercial artists, yes, but you know, you start looking at how it always seems to come back to this question of, you know, like building a platform for artists so that, you know, so that they're able to, you know, live and be creative, as opposed to worrying about where things are coming from or what's going to happen.
And I don't think we've solved it yet in terms of how the artist becomes a greater benefactor of all of this. We can scroll through thousands of pieces of content within a few minutes, 20 minutes scrolling through Netflix before you pick a show to watch. Mm-hmm. Each show is the result of multiple millions of dollars, how much of that actually got paid to the artists and the writers who created it.
And if we really had that level of understanding, would we be so quick to give our money and attention to it as opposed to just supporting artists directly?
Yeah, I don't know. I think awareness is certainly an important step in it. You can't tackle the problem until people are aware of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be really hard without the structure of these companies changing. It's going to become one of those things where people recognize it and feel bad about it, but feel powerless to change it. It's looking at the larger corporate structures that allow this to happen.
Yeah. So what role does entrepreneurship play in the story of artists now? How do they come together in ways that artists can build businesses without sacrificing creativity or being perceived as a sellout even?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And the way I'll answer that is nobody asks the tech industry if they'll stop innovating if they get paid more money. But this comes up all the time for artists. It's like, well, are we inhibiting creativity by putting a monetary value to it? Mm-hmm. And we literally don't ask this for any other industry. Like, oh, will these top chefs stop making incredible recipes if we pay them money? Like, will these tech companies stop innovating on the smartphone? Like, it's just stop packing information to it and into a smaller and more optimized form, right? We don't ask these questions. If anything, money has made it possible for technology to evolve within decades what was previously only possible within hundreds of years.
I didn't really think of it that way. That's what a great way to describe it, because when you think about, well, of course, they're going to keep being creative if you pay them more money, say the tech company, they're going to be more innovative. Why wouldn't artists be more creative if they had more money? Mm-hmm. It makes me think too, it's like, why are artists sometimes so willing to push money away? Why is there so much fear around that from maybe the artist side?
I actually give whole presentations on this, like an hour long webinar, So this is a part of the work that I do and the consulting that I do for primarily cultural organizations. And I'll give a consolidated answer as to why that is. So essentially you've got two forces at play here. The first is social conditioning and design, and the second is privilege and charity. And so first we'll talk about social design and conditioning. Mm-hmm. So we're all familiar with the narrative of the starving artist. And what a lot of folks are not familiar with is that the starving artist stereotype actually has a very capitalist origin. It's based the version of the starving artist we know today is based in an opera, La Boheme, The Bohemian, that was written in the 1800s. And it was wildly commercially successful. And it totally romanticized the idea of the starving artist and left out the fact that any of these artists from this period who were rejecting capitalism, rejecting the industrial age and capitalist greed, that those that stayed in poverty often died. And meanwhile, the artists who wore poverty as a brand and then later went back to the institution and to the academy, they ended up becoming a part of that same system. And so you think about somebody like Picasso. Picasso would be a classic example of someone who was an upper class, very wealthy individual, left that lifestyle, pretended to be a poor artist for X number of years, and then went back to being wealthy and capitalizing on this image that he built up on this romanticized idea of the artist who rejects wealth, right? And this is the image, right? And what I just described are a couple of examples of when people conform to the image. You've got those who We've been told this narrative enough, and when you tell people something enough, they believe it. And so you've got to conform to that idea, and who think that in order to be a truly like pure artist who's doing the art for art's sake, you have to reject these systems of wealth and these systems of greed in the world, right? And so you've got that. And then you've got the other ones who wear poverty as a brand to legitimize themselves as artists, to wear that romantic ideal, and then become wealthy off of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's another branch that comes off from the starving artist. And that's like, I would describe as like the rebel, right? Like the people who rebel against this. This is where you get your entrepreneurs. This is also where you get your outliers. Mm-hmm. The tough thing is like for the people who rebel against this dominant narrative of a starving artist is that it's very hard to fully break cycles of abuse and oppression within one generation. Mm-hmm. And even if you break it, you're still stuck with a lot of the biases or the effects of it. And one of the effects is that artists tend to have like a chip on their shoulder about how stigmatized our careers are. And so we're pushed to work that much harder to prove that we can really do it. And so I think of like how many artists I know who are the hardest working, most generous people I know, who are willing to do the work because they believe in the greater good of doing it, and who will do it even if they don't get paid. Yeah. And the irony of this generosity, of this charity through your artwork, is that it's actually subsidizing the very problematic systems that we disagree with. I mean, like you think about like what people take beef with when it comes to capitalism. Like the issue is that capitalism, especially the version we know today, exploits labor. It extracts as much value from labor as possible while paying as little as possible for it. Mm-hmm. And so, well, what does it mean then if these artists are working themselves to the bone for no pay? This is literally capitalism's dream, to be able to extract as much value as possible without having to pay anything for it. So that's part of what we're seeing. And then the other part is this privilege and charity aspect. So there's the starving artist stereotype, and next to it is the idea that art is for the elite. And a lot of people think this is a contradiction, right? Like, how does this happen that we simultaneously believe in the starving artist and that art is only for the elite? Right. And it's actually ideologically very consistent. Art is for the elite, it's in the semantics. The starving artist, the person, the laborer is starving. Art, the product, the property is for the elite. And so we see this with the value of high art getting just super inflated in auctions. We see it with any of these cultural goods and artifacts that, you know, like you think of like things that like archaeologists have dug up, things that have been looted from other countries, and they've been jacked up in value and stored in museums as a way of holding wealth via property. Mm-hmm. And so this has become the foundation of us seeing art as associated with charity. And then that also then feeds into this same framework, right? It becomes a self-sustaining system.
Right.
Part of our social conditioning is that art is for charity. And so then you see all these organizations encouraging artists to donate their work for art fundraisers to support some cause, right? Mm-hmm. And so then now you've got a sustaining system, a self-sustaining system where artists continue to feed into this, donating their work, donating their labor to support this foundation.
Wow. Wow. I can see why this is like a giant workshop that you do, because that's a lot. There's so much that goes into that. And just in that brief synopsis of what you talk about, I mean, wow. I mean, that's mind-blowing just how much is behind just a label of starving artist.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Where do you start to educate and dismantle from that point of view?
Yeah, I mean, the first is to name it and recognize it for what it is. And so what we just did there, like I named the things. Mm-hmm. Now we know what we're up against, right?
Like
you can't talk about racism unless you have a word for racism. You can't talk about sexism unless you have a word for sexism. And from there, like to have the language to be able to fight it, and then changing our approach based on that. And the harder part is the redistribution of resources. That's a bigger world peace problem than any of us are probably individually able to address. Mm-hmm. But the first step is being able to name it, in that when more of us like when more of us are aware of these things and can speak to them and mm-hmm. can fight them, like whether that's showing up at city council meetings and reading up on agendas, budget agendas within the city, calling these things out. Like mm-hmm. we do have collective power when we organize, and mm-hmm. we can organize when we have good information and we have a place to start. And yeah, so that would be one place to start.
I keep looking at the phrase creative labor as well, and understanding just what goes into creativity and what goes into the work that is done. I mean, we like to think that this stuff just magically shows up, but there's hours upon hours upon hours of effort and work that goes not only into the product, but sometimes the decades and many years of training and you know, learning and growing our skills. You know, it when you start really thinking about what goes into creative labor, it's embarrassing to think that it just magically shows up.
Yeah, that's a we're not terribly adept as a species at at noticing more than what we can visually see.
Yeah. One of the interesting things too is as you're describing this, it really exposes, I think, why working for exposure is so devastating and such a negative, I guess, system that just keeps artists stuck. Like, you know, I can't pay you, but I have this huge audience. You know, like that's one understanding why it's so negative. But are there instances where that can be leveraged for financial gain?
I think it can only be leveraged for financial gain and if you're already wealthy.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, and I think that's why we see primarily wealthy people who are, say, like at the head of an organization, of a nonprofit, on the boards, mm-hmm. like volunteering for these charitable efforts. We don't often see working class people in these roles. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that exposure for financial gain, the only time that artists can benefit, I think, from working for free is when you're doing it for yourself. So mm-hmm. if you're doing something to like build your own portfolio, like to do a passion project that you're interested in, like mm-hmm. that's what you're going to reap the most benefit from, because you're creating something that's really for you. And everything else, every other free bit of work you do, that's charity.
I think it's important to emphasize the label of charity at that point as well, because mm-hmm. I think you have to really consider what is it called when you work for free and it's not mm-hmm. for yourself. That's yeah. so powerful.
Right. And it's like, well, I don't know. Like, do you really want to do charity work for like United Airlines? Like, you know, when they like don't pay or like underpay you for some yeah. other contest that they hold, like is this really the charitable cause you're interested in today?
Like when you're giving your workshop, do you just see the light bulbs coming on as you're sharing this information?
Yeah, it's yeah, and like, you know, I think that's what I enjoy the most when mm-hmm. When I do teach these workshops or when I consult for an organization. It's that mindset shift. You know, mm-hmm. I try to stay away from just giving people like rigid rules, because yeah. there aren't really rigid rules that can be endlessly applicable. There are certainly best practices, but that the change you really need to see is a mindset shift. And that when those light bulbs go on, that's when you know that like somebody now has the ability to work on this problem themselves. They themselves are now capable. And this becomes a part of a new self-sustaining system that can replace the one that we have.
Yes. I'm getting excited because like there's a lot of hope in the message that you're bringing too. Like I feel hope.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. 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 We need people like you to feel hope and to feel capable of changing these things.
So one of the interesting things that I think you bring a valid point up with is the artist as leader.
Mm-hmm.
How can the artist become even more of a leader and use their voice to bring a sense of unity to society?
A lot of it is recognizing that artists inherently have the skills for leadership and connection. I mean, creativity is all about connecting different ideas. And the more creative we are, the faster we connect these ideas. And, you know, artists have always predicted societal change. You look at sci-fi and how often sci-fi precedes the inventions that we have in society. You think about everything from satire to dystopic novels and the potential social issues that they call out that end up coming true, almost like a prophecy. And it's not premonitions that make it possible for artists to do this, but a very adept understanding of behavior and of the environments that we live in. And so artists have the power of a very visionary form of leadership. And it's that visionary leadership that we so often lack in the present day world. We have a lot of examples of transactional leadership, a very like pragmatic leadership, but we don't have a lot of examples of visionary leadership. And I do believe that artists have the opportunity to fill that void. And that when we recognize it, we also need to train for it. I think that there's an assumption that leadership is a skill you either have or you don't have. And certainly people may have some innate skills that they start with, but like it doesn't all come naturally. And you have to train it. You have to practice it like anything else. And especially like an artist, I know every artist has had somebody say, oh, how nice that you have this God-given gift. And you're like, well, screw you. Like, this God-given gift took thousands of hours of training, right? And, right? And leadership is like that too. And so we need to recognize what are some of the innate skills that we have for it with our creativity, with our observation skills about society, and then what do we need to train to really make use of those skills?
Yes. Oh, I love the whole way that you broke that down with visionary leadership. And how do you start to train that apart from just is it the tools of leadership? Is it validating vision? You know, like what is it?
Well, I think it starts with thinking about what's possible. And just in thinking about like, well, what is it that we want? What do we want our art to be for? Or like if say like visual art or performing art, if the type of art that we make isn't the ultimate medium that we use, what can we take from the philosophy of being trained artists to apply to leadership? And I think a lot of what we've seen with the art world in the last decade is a shift away from the white box gallery and the idea that art can only exist in isolation. And I think that that's actually part of what's created the problems that we see in the world today. Certainly there's space for theory. We want to have theoretical frameworks developed and it does require some isolation to make that theory possible. But ultimately these things are existing in a real world context and artists are a part of this world. They're not isolated in a white box gallery or in a studio working alone.
One of the things that I love about where I live is once a year they do like artist tours where you can go to their studios. And what I love about that is it really brings you into their space so that you can see that it's, I guess, real, that this is what their space looks like. This is the work that they do. And so you start to see more of that narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think more that people can really engage with artists on that level, even outside of once a year of a studio tour, that you start to really understand on a deeper level what they bring to the conversation when it comes to societal issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So one of the things that you mentioned on your Now page is that you're growing your own business. And I like the words that you used here, smart and responsible way with a solid infrastructure. And I'm curious what that looks like in practice.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time examining my business processes. And so I think about, for example, with the client work that I do, what kind of framework I'm setting up for the client. Most people have not commissioned art. Like, we live in a society that typically buys things that are already made. And so it takes a lot of trust to commission something that you haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. And so I look at things like the framework that I'm setting up with the clients that I'm working with the social practice work that I do and the community engagement that I do. I look at who's benefiting from this labor and really making sure to center the people who need this work done. that they're the greatest benefactors of this. I put a lot of work into the budgets that I create, making sure that I have room in my budget for things like my apprenticeship program. I've hired and mentored 22 interns and apprentices in the last 3 years. And so I prepared a budget for that.
That's awesome.
And budget to be able to pay others. So like when I, you know, hire professional photographers for my work, I hire contractors to help on larger murals and public artworks, and and making sure that I have everything that I need built into that budget, so that I can be fair to people.
Well, and what's interesting too, as you're describing that, when the concept of fair comes up, you can't really be fair until you start looking at it that way. Like, well, how much does it cost to bring in a professional photographer, you know, to pay them what they're worth, you know? And it really, I think, expands your own mind when you go through that process of setting up a budget and working it in there and explaining why that's there. I imagine that's a huge part of the process too.
Yeah. It takes a lot of work to learn your business. And you know, I encourage other artists all the time to read some business books, take a business class. Most cities have a business center, like a small business development center or another incubation center where you can get information, and you can get information that's specific to artists, but you can also get information that's applicable to all businesses. And there's no reason that we shouldn't seek that information out as well.
Yeah. So another interesting thing on your Now page is that you say you're a reader, and I always love talking with readers. So what have you been reading lately that's been blowing your mind?
Yeah. Let's see. Well, I just finished Call Them by Their True Names by Rebecca Solnit. And she's somebody who's very good at naming things for what they are. And so she talks through things like gentrification and different like political issues with the Donald Trump presidency and names these things in these essays. And so it's a really lovely collection of essays. I also just finished reading The Three-Body Problem, which is the start of a sci-fi series, and it's a Chinese fiction science fiction novel translated by Ken Liu, and Ken Liu is a wonderful American author, and he wrote The Paper Menagerie, which everybody should read that and his other short stories in that collection. It's just phenomenal, but it's nice because, you know, with stories like The Three-Body Problem or like Ken Liu's other works, these are works that are couched in Chinese history and give you a sense of some of the things that came out of that. And then like through the lens of science fiction, seeing some of these questions about humanity. And yeah, so that's another one that I've just finished. I'm just now getting into On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong, which is just a really remarkable book. And not too far into it yet, so I can't tell you too much about it yet. But it's essentially an open letter to his mother who can't read, and for anybody who's lived through that second generation experience and that tension in a family, it's really lovely. Those are a few books that I can recommend right away.
That's awesome. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. I can't think of a better way to start my work week with some really deep, profound questions on my mind. I am so grateful for the work that you're doing, from the public art displays to the education that you provide people. Thank you for what you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jenny and that you'll explore her websites that I have listed at gwtw.co/477. Jenny really is an awesome source of inspiration and education about the world of art. Again, you can find links to all of her websites at gwtw.co/477. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.